Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. There are a lot of libraries installed in any Linux distribution. Libraries are super important to make programmers' jobs easier, because if there's a library to do something, you don't have to write the code to do the thing. You just have to invoke the library. The library itself usually has several header files and compiled library files that you can just reference. You can invoke, you can use a function from that library or create a class based on that library and then do the thing that you want to do within your application. It sounds simple, and I mean, to a degree, it is a lot simpler than not, than having to invent the code from the ground up. It is complex. I mean, you have to know what a function is. You have to know how to call that function. You have to know how to include the library. And then when you're compiling it, you need to make sure that your compiler knows that the library is on your system and how to get there and how to look for it and so on. So it isn't invisible by any means. It is something that you have to actively use and be aware of and kind of understand. But there are a lot of them, and we are only in the B section. We're at libburn is the next one in the list. We just did libblu-ray in the previous episode, so it's libburn this time. And we've been doing this for several episodes. I mean, just the L package, the library package. So I'm going to try to get through a bunch of them today, because there's just not that much to say about a lot of them. So libburn, for instance, very useful library, undoubtedly. Someone out there loves it. What does it do? It helps you burn media, CDs, DVDs, Blu-rays. That's what it is designed to do. It writes bits in a consistent way to a very specific media that has expectations on how those bits are delivered. That's libburn. That's all I'll say about it. Next is libkaka. Libkaka is an ASCII text rendering library. So, for instance, let's say you want to display an image, but for whatever reason, you don't have a graphics card for that, or you don't have a graphic server. So you can still potentially do that with libkaka, the color ASCII art library, because it will convert pixels it will use text instead of pixels to display an image. You can test this out. It's kind of a fun thing to do. Let's see. I tried just Kaka Clock, CACACLOCK, but it keeps telling me it can't open the font. So Kaka Clock --help tells me that I can use --font and then point it to a font, but I cannot figure out what format of font it wants. I've tried PCB, PCM, something like that. I've tried, you know, normal TTF. I don't know what it wants for its font, so couldn't get that to work. So then I tried Kaka View. This is supposed to display images. Try that on like a PNG or a JPEG, and it'll tell you can't do that. It needs a BMP, which is like a bitmap. Okay, well, we've covered image magic in previous episodes, so we can do convert path to the JPEG or PNG or whatever you need to convert, space foo.bmp. That ought to work. Kaka View foo.bmp, error loading foo.bmp, only bmp is supported. So not really sure what's going on there either. There's one last thing that we can try, which is Kaka Play, which is a video player. Seems even less likely to get this one to work, right? Well, I'll go to my folder with a bunch of video files in it. I'll select this WebM video. Can't imagine that's going to work. And what do you know? It 100% works. It can play a WebM somehow perfectly. Now, those are just demo applications. I don't believe that libkaka is necessarily distributed on the strength of those applications, but they are fun to look at. And, you know, in some mythical time where I'm sitting in front of a computer that doesn't have a graphics card that is capable of displaying graphics, or you know, something that's just headless and I absolutely need to see an image rendered as ASCII text, I guess all of these capabilities would be the way to do it. I'm not convinced about that. I think it seems cool, but I would like to see an image that I could look at as rendered as ASCII text and get a useful sort of idea of what that image is. You know, I'm not convinced. So I don't know. Play around with it yourself. I'm not convinced. I suspect it might be a novelty. Libcanberra is a XDG sound theme and name specification implementation. So it's an implementation of the XDG. That's the free desktop kind of structure around standards for desktops on free and open source software systems. So this specifically implements the sound system so that you can get audio notifications when you do certain things. Like if I were to... Oh, I guess I can't hear that. I feel like on one of my computers, I thought it was this one, that when I do the sound, you hear sort of a pop, you know, like a little pop sound. I know that some systems, for instance, when you plug in a USB thumb drive, you'll hear like a chime or a click or some kind of alert. So there are various alert sounds that you may hear on a desktop, and Libcanberra is a subsystem an implementation of this specification that is designed to be portable and easy to use across lots of different kinds of systems so that you can be sure that your desktop sound system, your sound alert notification, your event sounds are picked up and played as you wish them to be. Personally, the time that I run into this the most, it seems, is Linux Mint. I feel like Linux Mint really loves to implement the sound theme for their desktops. And honestly, I find some of their sounds a little bit abrasive. One of them has this horrible chirp sound to it, and it just feels like fingernails on a chalkboard practically to me. And I don't even actually mind the sound of fingernails on a chalkboard, so it must be worse than that. So it's weird to me, the whole idea of desktop sounds. Not weird like get it away from me weird, just interesting. I would like to hear more about sort of the history of sound effects, sound event sounds on desktops, because in a weird way I don't really remember them previous to Linux. Like I could be wrong because I misremember things frequently and things get sublimated, but I don't remember there being event sounds on certainly my previous operating system, and I don't remember it being a thing ever. Like, I just don't remember that being a thing. I mean, I know that it there. I don't think that it was like that it didn't exist until I started using Linux. I just didn't really feel like it was an expectation. And then when I got to Linux, it felt like there was this, I don't feel like everyone using Linux wants event sounds on their desktop. I just feel like when I started using Linux, it became clear to me that apparently there's a group of people out there who care about sound effects on their desktop, because otherwise why would these systems even exist? Why would it be default on Linux Mint, for instance? So that's just kind of interesting. I have noticed a little bit since using Linux, I have noticed that, like, you know, you'll hear Windows event sounds, like if you hear someone, I don't know what they're doing really, but you'll hear it, like if you're on a video call with them or something, you'll hear something happen on their desktop that'll chime or something, and you'll think, oh, I think that's a Windows sound. Is it a Windows thing, or is it a Windows and a Mac thing and I've just completely forgotten, or is it just really, really imbalanced, across the spectrum? Some people like it, some people don't, I don't know. So anyway, that's what Libcanberra does. It provides sound effects for specific actions, and you can usually find those actions in system settings. If you go to your sound, your audio tab, whatever, it's labeled as. There's usually some kind of section for like the volume of sound effects. And then if you go to, for instance, where is it? Desktop, no, workspace behavior, maybe? The workspace behavior? There's some place, desktop effects? No, that wouldn't be it. I don't know where it is in KDE. I guess that's further proof or evidence that I don't think I run into it that much, like in real life. Notifications? Maybe it's notifications. No. I don't know where it is in KDE. That's how little I think about it. But on Linux Mint, I can picture it. You go to the system settings and you go into, I don't know, you know, I think it's just sound. And you can actually set the different sounds for each different alert. And it you know, there's like, I don't know, 10 of them or 12 of them. I don't remember them including a whole lot of alternate choices, weirdly enough, but you can set it. Ah, here it is in KDE. Ooh, that's a lot of places to go. So you go to notifications, and then at the bottom of notifications, there's applications configure. Click on configure, and there's a list of all the applications you've got installed on your system, or at least all the ones that you've got installed that aren't flat packs, I suspect. Yeah, looks like it. And then, no, this is a flat pack, isn't it? Yeah, I'm not sure. And then you can click on that, and you can click on configure events. And then you get all the events that thing knows about, and then you can set the sound that gets played at that event. So there you go. That's your window into libcanberra from a KDE system. As I say, I'm just not a user of that. Let's talk about libcap and libcapng, or really libcape in a way. Libcap, libcape, libcapability is what that stands for. And there are two of them. There's libcap, libcapng. Ng in the open source world generally is, from what I've heard, it means next generation or new generation. And it is a way to denote that, hey, here's this thing that existed and I have re-implemented as a complete drop-in replacement. Libcap, libcapng, those are essentially the same. They serve the same purpose. They're two different implementations of that thing. Libcap 2.63 is the original, and its job was to discover in your application, you could use this to discover what the current user of your application is actually capable of doing. That's an important thing, because if the user doesn't have the right permissions to do a thing, then they can't do that thing. Whereas libcapng does the same thing, but it does it in fewer lines of code, essentially. I mean, that's its main purpose, really, is to make it simpler for the programmer to make these kinds of checks so that they can be more specific about what the user actually needs to do in order for something to work. So with the old libcap, it's the libcapng's author claims or asserts that with the old libcap, it was so complex, like 60 lines of code or something like that, to just check whether the user could do a certain task, that what people normally did or often did, they would just check if you're root. If you're not root, they'd say, nope, can't do it. You have to run this program as root. And that fixes the problem, just like everything is fixed when you just give yourself blanket permissions for everything. Now, the libcapng author asserts that this result in systems that aren't as secure as they could be, because everyone's just saying, just run this thing as root. That way I don't have to write the 60 lines of code every time I want to check whether you can actually do the thing that I want to let you do. You can imagine this with system daemons and, I don't know, something like K3B, although I shouldn't call that out specifically because I don't know how that works. I don't know what it's using. I mean, I guess we could try to really quick see whether it's using K3B, LDD, grep. So I'm just doing a LDD, user bin, K3B, pipe, grep, libcap. It is using libcap. Okay, so we could argue, possibly spuriously, we could argue that K3B, well, you know, I mean, we don't know. So, I mean, we could find out. We could look at the code. That would be the correct thing to do, but I'm not going to do that. Not right now, anyway. Let's say for a moment that K3B or an application like it is using libcap, and you want to write data to a peripheral, to a device. Now, that is normally not something that you can just do because we don't know whether you own that device as the user. It could be someone else's device in the system, and you shouldn't be writing data to it. So K3B probably, because I trust K3B, they've probably written quite a lot of code to try to figure out what kind of permissions you have set right now to see whether you can actually do that. Are you a member of the correct group and so on? As long as you are, then it'll proceed. Now, if K3B had been lazier, then they could have just said, you know what? I can't ascertain whether you own that device. Why don't you quit K3B and start it back up as root, and then we'll just be able to do whatever we want. But that's literally whatever you want, right? I mean, that's across the board. You are root now. You can do whatever you want. It's much, much cleaner, obviously, to have libcap, to have written all the code for libcap, or to do it in like literally two or three lines with libcap in G, to see, hey, I want to know specifically whether this user can write to this device. That's all I need to know. I don't care if the user is root, as long as that user is capable of doing this thing. That's what libcap and libcap-ng has been designed for. The argument for libcap-ng is that with libcap-ng, ideally, programmers will go to the trouble of being specific about what they need to know, rather than just saying with libcap, they're disincentivized from writing that 60 lines of code. Not the greatest programmer in the world, but I know that when you're writing a program and you have the choice of spending your afternoon checking for correct permissions or something, and you realize after looking at the library and reading the documentation, that's already taken like an hour. So you're reading the documentation and you realize, oh my gosh, just to check to see if my user can write to this DVD device, I have to do what? You know, and you just see 60 lines of code or whatever it is. I keep saying 60 because that's what libcap-ng says it would take. But you see that, and I mean, that is literally, to some programmers at least, that's an afternoon. To get that right, that's a full afternoon. For some programmers, it might not be. It'll be a copy and a paste and adjust a couple of little things. They know what they're doing, super simple. Maybe it takes 15 minutes instead of 5, maybe it takes 30 instead of 15, whatever. Not a big deal. To other people, it's almost a deal breaker. And either way, if you're faced with the choice of, shall I write all of this code or just a little bit of code, then you're going to take the little bit of code for lots of reasons. Not only does it keep you going for that day, like your momentum continues, you don't have to stop and learn about permissions and figure out all the different code that you need to write and where the code needs to go and how to make it sure that it's organized. But in the future, when you're maintaining your software, when you're making sure that there aren't any bugs and you're updating things, that's 60 more lines of code you have to think about every time you look at your code in the future. So if there is something simpler like libcap-ng that can make it easier for people to maintain code that is, you know, that does its due diligence for security purposes, then I think that's great. So libcap-ng is probably the way I would go were I faced with this kind of quandary. Next up is libcddb. That's an online CD database library. I feel like we've talked about CDDB before. It's a really useful big project out there in the world that simply acts as a catalog of all the different albums in the world. So freedb.org is no longer a project, but if you go to gnudb.org, gnudb.org, that's the new home for freedb.org database, and that's what you should use in all of your applications that need to query an online database. As I understand it, and I haven't looked at into it lately, but it does things like it figures out that this set of songs at these lengths seems like it must be this album. Because you figure, well, there's got to be a billion songs that are 3 minutes and, or, you know, 2 minutes and 44 seconds. I don't know how long pop songs actually are, but let's say they're 2 minutes and 44 seconds, a bunch of them. But how many 2 minute 44 second songs are preceded by a 3 minute and 1 second song and followed by a 2 minute and 58 second song? Probably not that many in that exact order. And of course, it gets bigger the more songs you have on an album. So that comparison of what's the exact order of these timestamps for each song, for each track, what can we guess that album might be? Now, if there's metadata that's available, then you can, you know, use that. I think some services also use audio wave comparisons, but I could be wrong about that, and that might not be in the database. That might be something separate. I haven't looked at the database itself recently, but certainly if you're using like EZTag or KID3, those kinds of meta tagging applications, a lot of them have options for a CDDB destination, and GNUDB.org is the one that you would use. And the reason that they can make those quick queries out to CDDB is because of libcddb. Next up is libcdio, and that is a GNU CD access library. So it contains a library for CD-ROM and CD image access. Applications wishing to be oblivious to the OS and device-dependent properties of a CD-ROM or the specific details of various CD image formats can just use this library. It's a library for working with ISO 9660 file systems. Lib ISO 9660 is also included in libcdio. That's libcdio. If you want to read from a CD, this is the library you're going to be using. You're going to open that device using a function of libcdio. ISO 9660 is a specification for optical media, and it was, you know, as long as you have this library, you can read and write. Well, you can read at least, and I think write to ISO 9660 really easily. It because the library, again, that's got it all figured out for you. So all you need to do is use a function from that library, and now you're reading information from ISO 9660. That kind of thing, this universal, I'm going to say universal disk format, but that is actually something separate. That's UDF. And I've talked about that before. UDF is used typically in DVDs as the universal disk format so that any device can read from that. ISO 9660 is a precursor to UDF. And I think we sometimes undervalue and take for granted the fact that, for instance, a CD, ISO 9660, I mean, everyone could use that. Like, you put it into any kind of computer with any operating system, and they just understood how to read those. And can you imagine if we had some kind of universal disk format, like UDF, to bridge all of the platforms? I mean, I just think that would be brilliant. I loved UDF for such a long time. I used to use it all the time because I needed compatibility, just, you know, super easy compatibility between different operating systems at that particular job that I was at. So I used UDF all the time. It was a great disk format. The problem was that the platforms I was using UDF on, like to go to from Linux to those systems, they dropped UDF support. Because, you know, optical media just became not as fashionable. And so they just were like, no one will ever need UDF on this platform again. And so it got dropped. So even the thing that was universal, they managed to make non-universal. Shocker, the company that I'm talking about was Apple. CDIO, that's that one. libcdio-paranoia is the CD paranoia library from libcdio. This is a CDDA reader distribution reading audio from the CD-ROM directly as data with no analog step between. So in other words, if you've got, for instance, audio on a disk, which people do sometimes, then the fear is that sometimes the audio could become corrupt during the translation from the disk to to a destination, whereas this library allows you to read that data just as raw bits. And when you're reading raw bits, of course, the computer can verify, did I get that bit or not? If I didn't get the bit, hold on, let me go back and try to read it. And that's what paranoia will do. It goes back and it'll try to read that bit until it gets a success. So libcdio-paranoia, in theory, can rescue disks that aren't playing in a CD player. Like maybe they're scratched, and so the data comes through distorted, or you know, it skips over that data or something. Whereas supposedly with libcdio paranoia and CD paranoia, those libraries, that'll rescue a thing. I have had horrible luck with that. I believe I've never rescued anything with paranoia. I'm not saying it's no good. I'm just saying, I guess, when I've resorted to it, whatever I was attempting to solve must have been too far gone, because it has basically never worked for me. So I don't think about CDIO paranoia or CD paranoia much at all, because it's just never worked for me. Happy to have it work for me at some point in the future, but so far, nothing. And although I guess, you know, if you argue that if I gave it enough time, maybe it would eventually work, because there's a disk, I think I probably still have it, that's pretty badly scratched, and I'd love to extract the data from it. And I've let it run for like days, and it hasn't worked. So I don't know, maybe I need to let it run for several years. I'm not going to do that though. Okay, next up is libclc, and this is an OpenCL library. OpenCL is the open computer language, or open computing language. It's a parallel processing language to help you get to be able to use CPU and GPU processing together. It is developed by the Kronos Group, which is the sort of OpenGL Vulkan group that does a bunch of, you know, most of the open source graphic work these days. They're huge. They do a lot of, you know, really important, like amazingly important work. And it's open standards. It's royalty-free open standards for 3D graphics, virtual and augmented reality, parallel computing, machine learning, and vision processing. Huge, huge, huge deal. And if you look through the specifications for OpenCL, which they have on Kronos.org, you can get there to the white paper, or whatever it's called. I call it a white paper. Maybe it's a, I don't know. Well, it's a specification is what it is, but it's paper and it's white. If you print it out on white paper, you get, I mean, there's companies here, you know, people from companies listed in the acknowledgments that are big deals: AMD, Apple, ARM, Broadcom, Blizzard, CodePlay, Electronic Arts, Ericsson, Freescale, Graphic Remedy, IBM, Intel, Imagination Technologies, Sony, Los Alamos National Laboratory, that's interesting, Kronos, Kestrel Institute, NVIDIA, forgot them, ST Microelectronics, don't even know what that is, Symbian, Texas Instruments, really, like, just companies that, you know, are a big deal. Which, going back to that discussion of, like, where's open source today, the fact that there's a Kronos group that acknowledges two pages of people from companies that have millions of dollars supporting their efforts, I mean, in some cases, billions of dollars supporting effort, and it's going towards a universally recognized, cross-compatible language to enable 3D graphics. I mean, that's a big, big deal. It's weird. It's a big deal, but it's also a scary thing, you know, because as an open source enthusiast, you might say, well, I don't want to be that dependent on the companies I've just listed. Like, those are companies that we probably don't necessarily like everything that they do. Did I say two pages? It's actually three pages of names, single column. So you might not think, well, I don't want to have to rely on all these companies to get graphics on my computer. And I think that's fair enough. But temper that with the reality that those companies exist, and they could be all doing their own thing. They could all be working in a silo, and we could have a case where every single different kind of computer or different operating system has a different way of rendering graphics. I mean, this kind of thing has existed before. It's not a good place to be. So the fact that some force is inspiring them to work together to provide something that everyone can use, that really is a big deal. It's an important thing. And once again, I don't think that is a foregone conclusion. I don't think that has to happen. It could happen differently. It could be that they don't do that. But for whatever reason, and it's the influence of open source, they've decided to actually work together. And we're all benefiting from it, depending on what you're doing with your computer. Maybe you're not benefiting from it. Maybe you don't even run a graphic server. Maybe you just type text. That's fine. But for the people who are like running Steam and playing, you know, the latest game, Cyberpunk 2077 or Starfield or whatever the latest game is when you hear this, then this is a big deal. Okay, so it says, this is just reading from the specification document because it is actually pretty interesting. I'm not going to read all 385 pages of the document, but a little bit of an introduction might be nice. Modern processor architectures have embraced parallelism as an important pathway to increased performance. Facing technical challenges with higher clock speeds in a fixed power envelope, central processing units, that's CPUs, now improve performance by adding multiple cores. Graphics processing units, GPUs, have also evolved from fixed function rendering devices into programmable parallel processors. As today's computer systems often include highly parallel CPUs, GPUs, and other types of processors, it is important to enable software developers to take full advantage of these heterogeneous processing platforms. So that's the statement, the mission statement of OpenCL. Basically, we have all of these different kinds of processors that are capable of really, really maximizing like the data flow, but a programmer needs to be able to access that power. And so OpenCL is one way to do that. A gateway, and there are others. OpenCL is not the only one, but I've only ever seen OpenCL. Everyone seems to be using it. I mean, you might notice that Microsoft isn't on this list. This is an old specification paper. It could be that Microsoft has come to the table. I don't know. I haven't checked. But certainly at the jobs in film that I've worked in, and there have been a few, OpenCL or you know, other similar technology has been the go-to solution. So I don't know what else what other people are using, but OpenCL is quite the popular solution. Okay, and quite powerful. So that's libclc is the library that you're looking at there. And that's BSD MIT dual license implementation of the library requirements of the OpenCLC programming language as specified by OpenCL specification. I think it's time for a coffee break. That's what I think. Come back and we'll pick up a couple more. Back with a cup of coffee. You know, you win some and you lose some. And this week, I feel like I kind of lost it because I went to the store this past week, got some coffee. And the place that I go, again, you bring your own container, you fill it up with stuff out of a bin. The coffee bins are three. There are three coffee bins, and they never have enough coffee in any of the bins to fill the container that I want to take with me. It's about a kilogram of coffee that I try to get for however long that'll last me. And they never have enough. So it's the same price. They don't care. So I just combine everything that they have into one bin, and that's my custom blend. Well, this time around, I had to do all three bins. Sometimes you only have to do two, you know, but this time it was three. So I have coffee in from three different bins in this one container that I have. And this time around, I'm hoping that it's just because I'm sort of on the top layer. And I hope that once I get further down, I'll get to the other bins, you know, because I mean, I didn't shake up the container. So it's like the coffee beans are just laying as I placed them. So I feel like there are probably three separate stratas of coffee bins in this container. Maybe I should shake it up. I don't know. But the coffee that I'm on right now, It's the leftmost container. Note to self, don't do that again. The leftmost container, not good. It's just not good. It's not flavorful. It's not strong. It's not strong. It's like not, it doesn't have flavor. It's not very good. I've tried percolating it. I've tried plunger. I've tried, have I tried? I don't think I've tried the espresso, the stovetop espresso. Maybe I'll try that next. So I don't know what's up with that bin of coffee. Not my favorite. So I'm still working on getting a truly satisfying cup of coffee out of this thing, and it's taking me a while. So yeah, it's just a hazard of the process, really. This is you go to a container, bring your own container store, and you take what you can get, and sometimes what you can get is not maybe your first choice. Okay, so we're back into libraries here, but before we start up again, let's talk a little bit. I think it might be worth talking about the difference between scripting and programming. A lot of us, I think, have kind of a instinctual knowledge of what the difference is between a scripting language and a programming language, but maybe we don't really think about why there's a difference. And some of you probably don't really know the difference. It all looks like programming to you, which would be fair because I think broadly it is. I think programming is generally defined as creating algorithms for a computer to repeat, and that qualifies programming. In a programming language that needs to be compiled, and programming in a scripted language, both of those things are programming. So it's completely fair to just broadly say, yes, I am programming right now. I don't think that's misrepresenting anything at all. And I think it's important to maintain the knowledge that those two are essentially the same processes, because it's silly, I think, for people to maybe view one kind of programming as maybe more important than the other. I feel like sometimes people might start to think, well, if you're not programming in C or C++ or those two, then you're not really programming, are you? You're doing the easy stuff. Well, it's not easy. It's just as hard. Well, it is just as hard to program in Python or Java or Bash. But the difference is that the difference is where you're spending your, is in part where you're spending your effort. A lot of the C stuff, I mean, the C demo applications I've done through this library section, you see kind of how many lines of code sometimes it takes just to get just to get down like one little thing, one process that maybe in a different language, you'd be able to just invoke exactly one module and suddenly you get the same result. So you're not spending the same time on the same processes. Now, and you may be, well, you probably are writing more code, the lower down you get. So I guess, is that harder? I don't know if it's harder. Does it take more time? Yes, it does. Possibly. Depends on where you are, too. I mean, if you've been writing C for 20 years, you're probably pretty fast at it. And there's probably a lot you can do in relatively little amount of time, even though you are writing more code. You're just doing it faster because you don't have to think about certain things. Whereas someone who's just started writing Python yesterday, it's going to take them a long time to even get just a window to appear at all. I mean, it'll probably take months. Well, maybe not. It depends on what they're using. Anyway, point is programming. Both are, any way you do it, I think, is a valuable way. I think it's a legitimate way. If you're coming up with a way to automate something for yourself or to do something different than what your computer can already do, I think that's great. But what's the difference? What is a scripting language versus a programming language? When are you scripting versus programming? And there is a difference. And many of us may think, well, the difference is that scripting is you're writing in an interpreted language, doesn't need to get compiled, versus programming that needs to be compiled in order to run. Even though sometimes that compiled process, happens very quickly or as part of a different process that you don't even see for yourself. You don't really do the compiling yourself because some other application is doing it for you. Whatever the case may be, there's like this knowledge that, well, programming is done with the end step of programming is compiling, whereas the end step of a scripting language is that you just run the thing. And literally that takes the form of GCC example dot C-O my sample return. So you're invoking a compiler. That's programming. Whereas with something else, Python, you just type in Python, and now you're in Python, and you can do things like print parentheses, quote, hello, close parentheses, and it prints hello, and you can try to struggle to get out of it. Oh, exit parentheses, that's how you get out of it. So there's a difference there. But here's the thing. When you're programming, and this is important for the section that we're in right now with the libraries, you're including libraries. You're including functions of libraries within your code. Whereas in a scripting language, you are more often than not, and there are some exceptions just to muddy the waters, but more often than not, broadly speaking, you're not doing that. You're not embedding code into your code. You are stringing code together. So for instance, if you just do a find in your home directory dash type f dash iname quote asterisk txt, so that's going to find all the txt files in your home directory. Wow, I have a lot more than I realized. Maybe I'll do license all capital dot txt and make that a name there. Well, there's a lot there too. Wow. There are a lot of TXT files in my home directory. Who knew? All right, how about if I just make it literally license.txt? There's still a lot. Okay, whatever. Doesn't matter. So there's a lot. So if I pipe that to grep for anything that also contains the word supertux, then I only find 1, 2, 3, 4 results. So I've just scripted something essentially. I mean, I'm doing it fairly interactively, so I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but I've just kind of scripted this process where my computer will find all the license.txt files in my home directory, and it'll filter out for me, because I've piped the output of find into the input of grep. It'll find anything that in that long path name includes the word supertux. And that's significant because that has find and grep are applications that exist, and I'm not embedding them into something else. I am just stringing them together. Now I could make this into a shell script, emacs myscript.sh. I could type the same exact thing, or because I'm lazy, copy and paste the exact same thing. And I'll put a little shebang bin. Wait, is it user? Yeah, probably user bin env space bash. Then I type the same thing. And now if I do bash dot slash myscript.sh, I get the same kind of output. But I still haven't embedded code into that script. I've simply invoked applications, and they're running as intended, but through some Linux POSIX trickery, I've strung them together. I've rewired how sort of one outputs its information and how the other one receives information. I've redirected output to input, and now they're together. Whereas in an application, as we've seen in the demo applications with programming, if we do my program dot sh, and then we do a hash include angle bracket standard io dot h close bracket, now I've included something. I've embedded the code from standard io into this application. I didn't have to type it all out myself. I don't have to go copy and paste the code, but that's what the include statement functionally does. And so now that code is part of my program. And in fact, that iteration of that code is part of my program. Because if I compile that right now, then that becomes that application. All those lines of code are now in my application. I think there's a significant difference to those two processes. And I think they're both very, very powerful. One, the stringing things together in a scripting language, that's really powerful because it's pretty darned intuitive if you know the things that you're stringing together. Like, you very much, you're building a new application by combining other applications. But the way that you know to combine those two other applications is because you've used them in other contexts. And I think that's probably why, in a way, grep is such a powerful little tool, because so many people, Linux users, when they're learning terminal, they learn grep pretty early on because it's something that you can pipe into. And then you develop more understanding of what grep can do. Like, oh, I could do a grep, but I could exclude the results instead of include them. Or I can do a case insensitive search instead of a sensitive search, and all these other these little tools that it provides you. And it becomes a component, a building block for more complex actions that you might want to do in your shell. And it's not just grep, obviously. I mean, there are lots of things that I think a Linux user uses here and there, maybe as an introduction to the terminal, or maybe just because you discover it and you start using it because it's useful to you. Rev being something that sort of leaps to mind, or even TR, just where it's like, oh, I see the utility for that all of a sudden. Now that I know how I know I want to get to a certain place. It's just, what's the easiest way for me to get there? Oh, what if I reverse the string and parse whatever's at the beginning rather than trying to find the end? Yeah, that's a lot easier. I'll do that. And then I'll pipe it back to rev to get it back. You know, and you can kind of develop all these little tricks yourself by using them. And that's harder to do with a library. Like, you can do it with a library if you practice. But how many people sit around practicing trivial seeming programming tasks? People do it, but not all of us do it all the time. And that's what it would take. You'd have to just sit there at your text editor, your IDE, and include a library and just see what you can do with it. Which, I mean, that's a valid way to learn a library, believe me. It is just, it's not quite as natural as learning the commands that are functional on an everyday basis. And that very frequently the default of those applications does something useful. Whereas with a library, because they very frequently do so many minute little specific things, even if you are just doing a little test run in a programming language, you do one or two things in a library, and as far as you know, you haven't done anything. All you've done is, I don't know, queried the size of a window, you know, like, well, great. Now what? What do I do with that? How do I even get that output? Like, the program didn't fail to compile, so I guess it must have worked, but you don't see the difference. It doesn't do anything for you. And I think that's why Bash is such a very, very useful introduction into the concept of programming, because there's so much you can do that is immediately useful. Whereas even something like Python, which, I mean, you know, people kind of debate whether that's a scripting language or a programming language, but even Python, like, there's this big chasm between just the normal user who says, oh yeah, I should learn how to program, and then a point in Python where they're actually doing something that's useful, which in a way is kind of why I've enjoyed introducing people to Ansible. In Ansible, I kind of think almost as a module of Python. I'm sure Ansible wouldn't be happy to hear me say that. I don't know how they feel about that. But I mean, in a way it is. It's such a Python sort of adjacent process where you're instead of writing Python, you're writing YAML, really. And then you run it in Ansible and it does a bunch of things for you. It makes sure that your end state is exactly what you've described. And that's a very user-centric kind of thing. It's purpose built to be used, whereas Python is just the tools. It's just hammers and nails, screws and screwdrivers and drills, and you don't know what to do with it. You don't know what it can do for you yet, because you don't even know how to use them. So maybe you can do some cool tricks like, oh, look, there's the time. I just got it from Python. There's a listing of my directory. That was an advanced task in Python. I had to include this special module, and then I had to, or do they don't call it include, right? They call it import. I had to import a module, which essentially is like the pipe action in a weird way. So you're including the module, or importing the module, and then you do the os.dir or the os.list, whatever it is. I think it's os.dir command, and you get the output. And that seems cool and useful, but redundant. I mean, you certainly already have ls, and it gives you much more useful output a format of output that's more useful. And it just takes a long time to get from, yes, I am typing things and making things happen in this language, and oh, I can actually, this is actually helping me get things done today. And with programming, I think that chasm is even wider than something like Python, which again, I think there's an argument that it's a little bit of a script, a little bit of a programming language. With a programming language where you're including libraries and having to learn about functions and methods and classes and things like that, I think it takes a lot longer to sort of get the feel for why that works and how that works and what's even possible, as opposed to a scripting language where you see all the pieces in front of you and each piece has a very complete description of what it can and, importantly, what it cannot do. And that is important because, I mean, that's kind of one of the drawbacks of a scripting language. You want to do something, but the tool set that you have available to you just doesn't have the specificity that you need for that thing. I've run into that myself. I can't think of a good example. I've tried to think of one, but sometimes you'll know exactly what you want to do, and you'll just realize there's just no way for me to do all of this as a one line command, or it's no way for me to do all of that without going out to some temporary file first and then processing the temporary file, that kind of thing. So scripting is, you've got lots of little boxcars, and you're tethering them together into a train. Programming, you're opening up all the boxcars, taking the contents out, and putting them into one single boxcar. That's my analogy. All right, next up for the libraries is libcue, C-U-E. So a cue sheet, C-U-E. Cue sheet is a metadata file describing the layout of a CD or a DVD, and libcue parses a cue sheet, and it provides an API for you to be able to then access that cue sheet, the parsed data, which obviously is important. I've never seen a cue sheet. I don't know what these actually are. I mean, other than that it's just been described. And the GitHub page that describes the library, libcue, does reference a Wikipedia sheet about cue sheets, but I don't know what a cue sheet is exactly. Although, the metadata might seem familiar. Like, you may have seen things like CD text file, flags, catalog, title, performer, songwriter. And for a while, there was a thing where some CD players were trying to make it a thing that CD text, like CDs would contain more data about what was on it for CD players to display them. And I imagine it was probably starting to ramp up, and then probably CDs fell out of fashion. That's kind of my, because I feel like I heard about CD text, for instance, and then kind of eventually, and then shortly thereafter, people had moved on from CDs. So I don't know if it was just a matter of timing or just not enough adoption or what. But anyway, that's CD text. This isn't necessarily CD text. A cue sheet itself simply has more information about the contents of the CD, which may or may not be expressed as CD text. It could just be, you know, metadata. What that's meant to provide, I guess, depends on the cue sheet. It is typically things like you know, artist name, performer, track name, things like that. But I've never dealt with that. But that's libcue anyway. That's what that does. Okay, next up is libdbusmenu. This is a GTK dbus menu protocol, a small library that was created by pulling out some common code from indicator applet, and it passes a menu structure across dbus so that a program can create a menu without really having to think about how it's going to be displayed on whatever other end. I think this is a great example of a library, of what a library does. This is the kind of thing, it's like, well, we're gonna look at what information goes into making a library, and we'll define that information. And how you decode that on your side is up to you. It's up to your desktop environment, but just the raw data, we can build that for whatever reason, from whatever sources, we can build that and then pass that over to you. And I mean, really, that's what inter-process communication and arguably even some network communication ought to be, really. Just send the data and the the structure, or like describe the structure, and then let the other side assemble all of those things in a way that the other side needs to assemble it, whatever that might be. It might be a different widget set than what you expect. It might be might not be a graphical thing at all. It might be just turned into plain text on some kind of terminal display or whatever. I think that's really, really, really vital, like that kind of separation of content and structure from, I guess, implementation, or I guess content from style, broadly speaking. There's an accompanying libdebus menu for Qt as well. That's libdebus menu-qt, and it's exactly the same thing. Then there's libdiskid. This is the Music Brain's diskid library, which attempts to create an ID for a disk by reading the table of contents of a CD and generating a unique identifier. And this is how Music Brains, the Music Brains database, organizes its catalog. This is the library for determining what a CD contains based on. Musicbrains.org is a little bit like GNU DB, I guess, or FreeDB. It's a place that catalogs all the albums available on CD. They do that by assigning unique IDs to known albums, which you can then ideally access through libdiskid. Okay, probably the last one, libdmx. I mean, we've gotten through the C's at least. That's a good thing. Libdmtx is a package that enables programs to read and write data matrix barcodes of the modern ECC200 variety. So this is, I mean, it's barcodes. This is important for, I think especially for like small businesses, because a lot of times they struggle with, well, how do we process items in stock quickly, because it's got this barcode on it, and we don't, you know, like, what do you do with that barcode? Well, I don't know if this library is really going to change anyone's life directly, because the chances are, if you're just working, you're a small bookseller, you know, you're just trying to process books, you're probably not going to go and grab this library and program a solution for yourself. But that this library exists obviously helps programmers create applications like little payment, or the POS, point of sale applications, to help people process barcodes. I think the other problem with barcodes, of course, is that they do require some kind of reader, which historically has been, you know, it's been a special device that it's not really sold usually, just kind of like off the shelf. You don't just go to a store and get a barcode reader. You have to like find a barcode reader. Luckily, in my limited experience with this, they've been pretty generic. Like, once you find a barcode reader, you just plug it in and it just reads in stuff as a serial, you know, just raw data, just a string of numbers, really. It's really basic. Again, basic to you and me, not basic to someone who just wants to make their computer look and see what book they're holding up to it, or you know, whatever item it is, as an independent album, or you know, like whatever you're selling at your little store. So I don't know. I dislike it. I don't like it. I think QR codes, in a way, has been revolutionary, combined at least with like the prevalence of like digital imaging, like, you know, your phone in your pocket. So I mean, that's been huge, and I think on a pragmatic level, that's where really I think all of that should go. I think we should stop with the barcodes and just use QR codes. I think that would be much, much easier for everyone, because I mean, even with open source libraries to look at the barcode, it's, again, what are you going to do with it? Actually, you know what? I think we could get through the D section as well. We've only got like two D section, or two libraries left in D, and then we would be in E. So let's do those two, and then we'll stop this episode. So libdvd-nav and libdvd-read. These are libraries you use every day if you play DVDs on your computer. I still do that. I play DVDs. I have a little outboard. Well, on my tower, I have a built-in optical media drive now. But for my laptop, I have a little outboard DVD player. It was like $20 back in the States, and I've been using it for the past decade. And libdvd-read can read the video disc, and then libdvd-nav helps the application reading the thing actually be able to navigate through the menus, and multi-angle playback if your DVD has that, and interactive little DVD games, things like that. So all of that stuff, That's provided by, or the reading is provided by libdvd-read, nav by nav. And really, both of those are provided by VideoLAN. So if you're using VLC, then that's where all of this stuff comes from. If you're using VLC as a flat pack, of course, then you are using these libraries again. They've been downloaded again for you. You're not even using the ones that have been installed on Slackware. But you know what? You didn't have to really think about it. It just happened magically, and that is the magic of Flatpak. So there you go. That's all the C's and the D's in the library section, which is great, because now we're in the E's, and there's only two of those, so... I mean, really, I'm almost tempted to do those now, but I'm not going to. We're going to stop the episode here. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.